Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Sharif Vakili, investor at Polaris Partners and primary care physician at Stanford. Join Sharif in exploring the extra clinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is the Chief Clinical Officer of Google and a critical care physician, Dr. Michael Howell. My guest today is the Chief Clinical Officer of Google, a critical care physician by training, a national expert in healthcare delivery science, a researcher, and also author of the book Understanding Healthcare Delivery Science, which another of our podcast guests, Sachin Jain, lauded as a landmark text that should be part of medical and nursing school curricula everywhere. Yeah, I know, right, Michael? Dr. Michael Howell, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's such a privilege to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we get to do this in person, which is a treat. We don't often get to do that. So thanks for extra making the time to accommodate this in this way, too.
Yeah, you bet. I'm sorry the room is so boring, but...
No, this is it. I know the audience can't appreciate it, but there are nice green walls here. Anyway, Michael, you're the chief clinical officer of a big tech company that has been perhaps the most active in healthcare or one of the most active in healthcare. Can you just share a little bit to start about your role and responsibilities as the chief clinical officer of Google?
Yeah, I'm part of our health team that's led by Karen DeSalvo, and my job is to oversee the folks who work across the company with clinical and related expertise. So we have teams of doctors and nurses and other folks who work with our colleagues in search or in YouTube or in cloud or in research, and we work to help the company make the best products that touch people's health.
Yeah, how many providers work under your umbrella? About like how big is that team, and what's the varied background of people's clinical expertise?
Yeah, we work really hard to have a wide variety of expertise. So we have some people like me from academic medicine. We have other folks who have a wide variety of practice experience. We have folks who have substantial practice experience in other countries and other environments. We have nurses, we have health economists. So we work to have kind of all of those kinds of expertise that we need to bring to bear.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, what I'm really excited to share, because many of our listeners are medical students, residents, trainees, who are exploring, obviously, different paths they can do clinically. Do you have a sense that the people who are exploring coming to work at Google in these varied roles knew that they wanted to do this? Do they still see patients part-time if they have that kind of license to practice? How have you seen sort of people find themselves in this journey? You could maybe even share how you found yourself too in this journey yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, my story is who would have ever thought this was a job that existed?
Right? Yeah.
and it's like this, it's this blessing to get up and do it, but it would never have been on my roadmap. So I'm my short version is between 1995 and 2017, I was either training or taking care of sick people, and running parts of hospitals and health systems. If you'd asked me any time along, would I ever have a job like this, I would have been like, oh, that's crazy town, right? Like there's no chance of that. Other people have known that they wanted to do this kind of work for a long time. We have folks who have had really extensive practice experience over decades. We have folks who work with us for most of their time, but not all of their time, and in their other parts. And we have folks who see patients. It's an early kind of role, right? These roles haven't existed on the planet for very long.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I expect 10 years from now, we'll know a lot more about how people do in these kind of roles. And
so if like that. A medical student were to come and sort of been thinking about their career arcs, thinking about a specialty, thinking about whether to do residency sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense on how to sort of fit in tech within the career story? Is it something that somebody should think about after clinical training, after being in practice early on, jumping out of medical school for? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, people do all of those and are very successful. Mm-hmm. You know, my own take on it is that, you know, you should do medical school and residency if you want to take care of sick people and mm-hmm. if you want to help people stay healthy. It's a lot of work, and it is the moment of getting to be with a patient or a family or a patient and a family in really important times in their lives is a amazing moment. There are many ways to be in health tech, not having done medical school or nursing school or pharmacy school. And my view is that the main reason to do those things is because you want to take care of sick people for some meaningful part of your career.
Yeah. So don't necessarily, if you're pre-med, for example, go to medical school to get into health tech.
Yeah, that's my advice. It's hard. I mean, you know, right?
Yes.
It's hard work,
yes.
Right?
I agree.
And, you know, I get asked all the time, like, do I need to do internships? Do I need to do all these things?
Yeah.
There are a whole bunch of roles out there, right? If you want to be the person picking the, like, batch training size on the TensorFlow instance, then, yeah, you're going to need more than, you know, knowing the cardiovascular physiology.
Sure.
But there are a whole lot of roles that that the important part is being able to have deep clinical understanding and then bring that to bear on technology.
Do you think the opportunities that exist at Google for people interested in healthcare technology also exist at Amazon or Apple or Facebook? You know, we had the VP of Health at Apple, Saumil Desai, on as well. And she's lovely, like you, smart, a practicing physician with deep expertise in healthcare. Any thoughts on how the roles may differ between the different large tech companies, or even, you know, how your role may differ if you were at Google or Amazon or Facebook or Apple or anywhere else?
Yeah, it's been really gratifying to see nearly all of the large technology companies invest in health and healthcare in a serious way. And I think we've really seen that play out over the past few years. And the opportunity here of helping people is so large. There's this amazing health affairs study from a couple of years ago that talks about amenable mortality, right? So things that, if we just kind of did things we already know how to do, people who wouldn't die. And their estimate is that that's about 8 million people a year who die worldwide, whose mortality is amenable to things we already know how to do, at an economic cost of $6 trillion a year. And
is this like safety stuff, like people making medical errors, or is this on top of that?
These are things of lack of access to care,
uh-huh,
or inappropriate application of healthcare.
Interesting.
And that's before you get to the social determinants of health and the structural determinants of health that probably have much more impact, much larger impact,
sure,
on that. And so if you just start there for a second, it becomes clear that the enemy is diabetes and high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And that we're just at the very beginning of figuring out how technology can help in that space. And so, you know, for me, I don't have insight into other areas, but for me, the gratifying thing is seeing all of the different ways that technology companies are trying to help address this problem space. Mm-hmm. That I've just been thankful for.
Yeah. I always like to reflect on how incredible physician leaders like yourself, through different walks of life, tackle this question of how we can make our health system better. It's like so frustratingly stuck. And it's interesting to get your perspective from the tech stands of where there's that low-hanging fruit, things that really need to change. Do you feel that the ways that people think about these problems within, and I think this might get to actually, I'd love to mention a little bit about your piece in NEJM Catalyst you talked about recently, you know? It's like, do you think the way that the problems are thought about and articulated in tech and in healthcare, those two different domains, get it? Like, how have you thought about, you know, having seen, been on both sides, how things are discussed, whether there's a true understanding of how to approach these problems. And we had, for example, the president of that Verily on, Vivian Lee, who's talking about this exact question of like how to fix healthcare. What's been your experience and how to culturally get these different minds, if you will, come together to tackle these problems?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of lenses to that question. It sounds like a straightforward question, but it's really a subtle question. So the first is that lived experience in having been in an environment matters a lot to understanding how things are on the ground. Part of the role that my team plays is bridging those two worlds, right? If you haven't taken care of people, then understanding the problems of doctors and nurses takes a while. We have actually an amazing set of colleagues with this whole discipline of user experience research are really good at that. But there's also some intuition you get from that. The flip side of that is that all of us have had family members or ourselves who have been through healthcare. And many of us have had family members who have suffered unnecessarily because of errors, because of delays in diagnosis, because of lack of access to care. And so one of the things that's been very gratifying is the intuition and the understanding of the challenge of the space that our colleagues across the company have had really from the very beginning when I started.
Could you talk a little bit even more in this context on the NEJM piece that you recently, and I'll put a link to this for sure, this podcast, that you and Karen DeSalvo had written up. It's on how to build successful clinical teams in large tech companies, the role of clinical teams, and you know this question we're touching upon, the role of bringing that cultural shift, at least from the physician lens specifically, of a clinical collaborator to a healthcare innovator. Can you share a little bit more about your findings and this study that you came out with recently?
Yeah, I mean study is probably overstating, you know, what the article is, I just ticked over into my sixth year here. So I've been here 5 years. And I was one of the really early hires in the clinical space. And we spent, 5 years figuring out, trying different ways of working. And the piece is really about stuff that that Karen and I have learned during that time of doing it in ways that we think that these learnings, that, you know, context really matters. So they may be applicable to no one, okay. But I've gotten a lot of outreach from people across the industry.
Sure.
After that, which I'm always shocked that anyone ever reads anything. And so what we did was try to write down some of the lessons that we've learned during the time. And I would say they boil down to this. The first is you have to think about what is it that your company does or wants to do in health and in healthcare. Is it just that they need to take care of their employees? That's really important. Do they see health as foundational to part of the business, or are they trying to grow in an area? The second thing is you need to decide what you believe in. So we believe in evidence, we believe in equity, we believe in ethics, We believe that health is more than healthcare. And those are foundational things that let you then be consistent in the way that you approach a very large company in our case. And then there's some things that translate startlingly well from clinical practice into healthcare. But one of the really important learnings is that the way we think about it when we have an embedded team with search or YouTube or the hardware team, is that the clinician needs in some ways to act like a very good primary care doctor. And by that I mean a really good primary care doctor who's like worth their weight in platinum, if you have one. A really good primary care doctor understands you and your circumstances and your history, and then adapts their like 20 years of schooling to your condition and to your individual circumstances, and that's really helpful. And so we think about clinicians needing to understand the product constraints, the business context, the technical constraints, and then lends their 20 years of schooling in a way that's really helpful to the teams that are making decisions. It can be different than clinical practice. So, you know, I was an ICU attending for a long time.
Yeah.
You have to make hundreds of decisions every day. And by law, you're the person who decides. It's really different than working in an environment where you're not the decider. So the aspect of being able to work extraordinarily effectively as part of a cross-functional team is also one of the core learnings from that.
Yeah. What kind of training do you think most prepares somebody with a clinical background whose brain works that way to put themselves in these shoes? You know, is it business school? Is it just getting on the job and going doing tech? Is it just humility? Is it becoming a primary care doctor? Have you seen any traits or life experiences that seem to create the tools necessary to be able to advance in this way?
Yeah, one of the things we talk about in the article is roughly the phenotypes of work that you do.
Yeah.
So some of our team members are product-oriented. Some of them are research-oriented. Do you know the journal Nature?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so Nature does this thing called Nature Index, which is they look at companies or other organizations that have had how much impact they've had on the peer-reviewed literature.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, companies and globally and life sciences, you know, Alphabet is number 5, right after 4 pharma companies.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of research. The skills you need for that are different than the skills you need to be product-oriented. Mm-hmm. We have some folks who are ecosystem-oriented, and we have some folks who help across the company in an internally facing way. And so the skills you need for each of those are a little bit different. Humility is foundational to them.
Yeah.
The ability to actively listen is foundational to them. The ability to crisply analyze complex problems that you've never seen before is foundational to all of them.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Do you find in the clinicians that you hire and work with,
yeah,
any sense of even imposter syndrome to be able to feel comfortable to enter these new roles and thinking these new ways? Has that ever come up for yourself?
Feels like that's been a foundational element of every stage of my career.
Yeah.
Are there people who don't have that? Like your first day being an attending, you're like,
I know,
wait, right? My name is at the end of the chart? How did that happen?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel any different to me.
Yeah, because I often find that it can feel so intimidating, this idea of entering business or entering technology, or what is a product? I don't know, product, all you know is research, right?
In
your, you know, academic lens, that you sometimes don't recognize that there are elements of your experience that translate over. And I love your perspective and that you share around this.
Yeah, I think that the sentence you just said, I think is worth emphasizing that you may not realize that there are aspects of your experience that translate really well.
Yeah.
Being able to recognize when that's true is really important. And it's also true that recognizing when it's not true is really important. So in this, when I joined, I was part of the team that in the research org is where the health efforts, originally grew up when I joined. And so you have all these people who are like inventing the next kind of machine learning, like
yeah.
They're, next door to you. And it took me a long time to realize that there were, you could translate epidemiology into machine learning. So in this mm-hmm. book I did, there's a table of, I forget the exact title, but is translating machine learning to epidemiology. So understanding when things that you've done before translate one-to-one, even if the words are different,
yeah.
is super
yeah.
helpful.
Yeah.
And understanding when there is something that is out of your field of context and that you need to really ramp your learning curve is also important.
Yeah, it is interesting how just different disciplines too emerge with different jargon, different language, and it can feel foreign, but we are often saying many of the same things.
Yeah.
I want to take this moment to actually transition. Do you, from your vantage, what do you see as just general accelerants and barriers toward technology innovation in healthcare? And how often do you find yourself, interfacing with some of those accelerants and barriers?
There's a little bit of an implication there that technology is good.
Right.
That's not always the case.
Yeah.
There's a classic perception, which is grounded in reality, that healthcare can be slow to change. And so it's not like people who are in healthcare aren't smart, right? Brilliant. They're brilliant. And so the question should be, when is that perception there and is it right?
Yeah.
And I think that there are a couple of pieces to that. So first, healthcare is a complex adaptive system. And I mean that in the precise definition of the term. One of the fundamental characteristics of a complex system is you can't always predict the outcome of a new intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you change one thing, you think you know what's going to happen, but in any complex adaptive system, the outcome of an individual perturbation is not always predictable from that. When I was responsible for the quality and safety of a health system, I was anxious whenever we changed anything because there are often second and third order effects that you don't predict ahead of time. Part of the reason that healthcare has sometimes been slow to change is because there are times when healthcare changes and has rapid adoption of something, and it hurts a lot of people because of second and third order effects. That's one reason. I think the second reason is healthcare is in the United States context is fragmented. It's fragmented technically, it's fragmented organizationally. Those things are hard to overcome. Also, sometimes you see healthcare adopt things very quickly. The change in telemedicine over the course of the pandemic is a canonical example of that. But we've seen other things. In my clinical practice, we saw the rapid adoption of tight glycemic control across the United States in ICUs with limited evidence in ways that are probably not good, but it went from one place is doing it to nearly everywhere is doing it in a span of just a couple of years. So there are things that can spread quickly, but there's a lot of complexity to it.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And actually, just because of the order of how these interviews were recorded, you touched upon something that the CIO of Stanford Healthcare, another Michael Pfeffer, touched upon. I won't spoil his answer, but I'm curious your thoughts as well around this idea of, do you think that it is the case that physicians or clinicians or health systems don't change their behavior, that they're sort of stuck in their ways, and that's part of the one of these barriers that you had mentioned, or not necessarily?
It varies.
Yeah.
I mean, healthcare is local, and so it's probably worth saying for this context that that most of my career, in addition to taking care of sick people, I worked on quality and safety and system change in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And sometimes things spread very rapidly, and sometimes they don't, either because of active resistance or passive resistance, but often because you haven't quite got the intervention right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you've lucked into having the correct design of whatever it is you want to do to improve outcomes or efficiency, it's not unheard of that you see that get rapidly adopted or even auto-adopted and spreading before you're quite ready for it to spread to new practice areas.
So, Michael, you were talking about this really interesting recognition that one of the big barriers of adoption of technology is how fragmented our healthcare system is. But we also don't see much adoption, or at least the same way or same kind of adoption, in like a centralized health system like you might see in Canada or the UK or Singapore, or even sometimes selling into the VA can be challenging. Do you have any thoughts or reflections on this paradox, or how we might be able to approach this challenge from a technology adoption and innovation lens?
Yeah, it's so I think there are two things. I think one is that fragmentation is a barrier, but that doesn't mean that the lack of fragmentation is a facilitator necessarily. It just removes a barrier. Mm-hmm. That's one piece. The second is when you're on the health system side of this. So thinking as 20 years of my career rather than at Google, one of the things that you're trying to evaluate is what's the evidence that something works. And so when someone comes and says, I have this new medication for condition X, here are the randomized controlled trials and the FDA approval, and here's the cost, you have a reasonable understanding of how to weigh those risks, how to weigh those benefits and costs. Technology is different in that the evidence base for it is still pretty early in its development, and that some of the hesitation in some health systems is looking for the evidence of, do we know if things are going to be helpful or not, rather than the promise of future helpfulness. And so, for us, we think about that as a factor in trust. And so we think about two kinds of trust. And let me sort of pull those apart for a second.
Yeah.
So the first is, because trust is foundational here. And the first kind of trust is, are your data private and are they secure? Because if they're not secure, they're not private. Do you have control over them? All of those things that are critically important and that we work really hard on. In healthcare, there's a second kind of trust that you only earn over years and years and years, and that is, do the things that you make, do you have evidence that they help doctors, that they help nurses, that they help pharmacists, and that they help patients, that they help people? And so for us, one of the values that we've held is, how do we work on that second kind of trust, and how do we show our work over time? So I often get asked, I can send you this link, but our team has published 150 papers in health and healthcare. That's really unusual for a large tech company to do. And I get asked all the time, why do you do that? Like, why do you publish in New England Journal and JAMA? And it's not because journal editors move at the speed to which Google is accustomed. It's because we want to show our work over time. Because of that, we believe in building the evidence base here. And I do think that that's another important barrier.
This actually touches upon a question I think a few people have wanted me to ask, which is this idea of a unified EHR. And everyone looks at Alphabet as a possible, you know, force that could bring that, but it's obviously not happened. Do you have any takes on the challenges for a player like a Google to make a unified EHR or single accepted personal EHR? And, you know, where does a product like Google's Care Studio, for example, fit into this equation, if at all?
Yeah. So the digitization of U.S. healthcare happened quite rapidly. Over just a period of a few years, in response to payment changes and things like the High Tech Act, it went quite quickly. A few years ago, Bob Wachter and I wrote a piece in JAMA about this idea of the productivity paradox. And one of the things I learned in writing that was that there is the productivity paradox is a historical construct. And you see it in things like in the early 20th century, when factories first got electricity, they did not become more productive. All they did was replace the giant water wheel that they had used before with a big motor. And it took 10 to 15 years before they figured out how to redesign the work to the new technology, where they had little motors at all the working stations. Same thing happened in banking. Computers came in. Nothing really got better for a while. And then 10 years, 15 years, 20 years later, the work gets redesigned. Where are we now after the digitization of health in the U.S.? We're into the 10 to 15 year mark after that. And so we're at where historically you might expect work redesign to start happening instead of the replication of existing processes. So the digitization of U.S. healthcare is an amazing step forward. But also, we haven't been able to take as much advantage of it.
Yeah.
And it's not, from the historian's perspective, it's probably not all that surprising.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So, you know, Care Studio is this way of taking the things that Google has learned about searching and information summary. It's a really hard problem, but we have 20 years of experience with it. And then wrapping that around the electronic health record.
Mm-hmm.
And so the my favorite Google statistic that I've learned is that today on Google.com, 15% of what people type into the search box will never have been typed in before in human history. It'll be the first time it's ever been typed
in.
It sounds shocking, but like language is a very high dimensional construct. And we have 20 years of engineering experience in how to handle things like that. And so Care Studio wraps that around the electronic health record, but it's not an electronic health record.
That's very, very interesting. And thinking about it in that historical context is so insightful and I think even encouraging. There was a study in 2021 that came out that showed that currently we talk about diabetes and hypertension, 50% of Americans still have an A1C over 7%, 69% of Americans who have hypertension, their systolics are greater than 130. And that number is basically unchanged in the last 15 years. In fact, in some dimensions, it's a little bit worse, which is so bizarre because there's been so much technology innovation. You know, during this time, RPM has become a big thing and we're trying to do all these different things around healthcare. But, you know, it seems to not have picked up yet. And maybe it's just a matter of time and hope and learning.
I'm hopeful about it.
Yeah.
I would say cautiously optimistic.
How do you, in your position, also think about maybe just generally build versus buy of technology within Google or within a tech company? How do you encounter that question periodically?
Yeah, it's... So Google has done both over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So we've built things. Search is a good example. Mm-hmm. And in the probably the easiest example that's related to health would be that a couple of years ago the company acquired Fitbit.
That's right.
And has been focused on how to integrate all of the great things of Fitbit with all of the great things of Google. And so you see a variety of those things, and it depends on the specific circumstance about how you would think through that problem.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on how Google even approaches this from the different pieces of its ecosystem? We've got, you know, Google proper, there's Verily, there's Google Ventures, there's Startup Incubation. Do you have a sense on how these different, you know, hammers, if you will, look for different nails of opportunity? And is there integration of these efforts ultimately at a big tech company, or is it more siloed than people might think? How is that sort of, you know, strategically explored?
So Alphabet is the overall company. Alphabet has different companies. I work in Google. Alphabet has some companies that are health or healthcare specific. Verily is maybe the best known for that. Verily is its own company. It's got its own board. And so, you know, we know all the folks at Verily. We collaborate on something. So an example would be we've worked together on using AI to prevent blindness from diabetic retinopathy. But they have their own board and are a separate company.
Transitioning then to our last question, I think ties a lot of our points together. And thank you so much, Michael. This has been a lovely conversation. Yeah. If we were to just think about U.S. healthcare writ large, the good, the bad, the ugly, what are pieces that you feel brings you hope and you're excited to see? And what are areas that if you had a magic wand, you wish you could change or provide more consternation?
Yeah. Let me say the hopeful thing, which is it's not that long ago that things were really different. So there's this thing that people sometimes talk about the Great Divide, and I forget the exact year, but whatever, 1912-ish, that before that time, if you were a random person seeing a random physician for a random condition, you were more likely to be hurt or killed than helped by that. And there was a year when that became not true. And we've seen these amazing leaps forward in the technical ability of care and in the delivery of care and in the environment that has resulted in, until the past few years, longer life, better economic productivity, all these things. And this is, it's not just, you know, 120 years ago. It's during my career, when I started, if you had a heart attack, you were twice as likely to die after you got to the ER as you are today. When I went to medical school, HIV was an inpatient disease that killed tons of people, and now we can manage it chronically as an outpatient. Your chance of having polio worldwide was markedly higher than it is today. And so we've had all of these amazing advances that have just been, even during my career, I've seen them. And so that gives me hope. My dad is having a surgical procedure later this week. And it's, you know, his chance of having a bad outcome from that is dramatically less than 30 years ago, right? So there are all these things that are really good about that. The thing that is the most frustrating for the U.S. for me is that compared to the amount of effort we put into healthcare, the outcomes we get are not what you would expect from the amount of investment that we have, and that they've been getting worse over the past few years. Yeah. I wish that I could fix that. I will add that, like, one of the great things about my current job, you know, Google has a whole bunch of products that more than a billion people use every month. And so that tells you by definition that the majority of our users are not in the United States. And so getting to see the progress across the world, not only in the United States, has been a real, has been something that I've been very grateful for in this role. But I still wish we could fix the outcome challenge that we have.
Yeah, in the US. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. This was so terrific. What a treat.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you have any suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at info@tdio.org.